We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Or good morning or good evening, whatever you're listening to us on.
Yes, we're there whatever you. Time zone you're in.
All right, so another wild ride on planet Earth this week. Starting with local and looking towards the recall vote that happened earlier in the week and the results that are continuing to stream in.
Yeah, the final election of the year was the vote in the Shamasawant recall. District 3 residents marked their ballots and mailed them or dropped them off in drop boxes. And on Tuesday, the initial count on election day showed that the recall Sawant folks were ahead by about 6%.
Which the Seattle Times tried desperately to spin as the final result.
Yeah, but of course we know that Shamasawant has overcome much bigger leads before. And sure enough, by Wednesday, she had pulled ahead by a couple of hundred votes. And then Friday's update showed Shamasawant.
No, actually,
ahead.
She was trailing on Wednesday. She pulled ahead on Thursday.
I think she had narrowed the gap on Wednesday to about a couple hundred votes. And then Thursday, she pulled ahead by a couple hundred votes. And then on Friday, yesterday, she was ahead by 249 votes. And of course, no one is really expecting that to change, even though there are some ballots that arrived without signatures or that are being challenged.
Yeah,
I don't think there are going to be enough to overturn it.
And Shama's campaign is by far the most experienced election operation in town in terms of being able to do ballot chasing.
Yeah.
So if anything, her margin will increase as those ballots are qualified. Her campaign declared a quote tentative victory unquote, which is they're very carefully couching it, but that's understandable. But she has overcome an enormous amount of money spent to try and get her off of city council. And once again, her grassroots campaign was able to stave that off. This is the closest of the elections she's faced. She's also been reelected twice and elected the first time. This is the closest call she's had. And that's understandable because in past elections, she's always had a very flawed opponent. And so there's a certain amount of people in her district who say, well, I don't really like Shama, but I don't like this other person more. This time it was just Shama on the ballot. And, and anybody who would replace her, and we can imagine what type of person the business community would put forward to replace her with a lot of money. That was not on the ballot this time, and people weren't necessarily thinking about that. They were just thinking about Shama. So it's not surprising that it's closer, but the amount of money that was spent to get rid of her is staggering.
Yeah, it was this was a race where $2 million was spent if you add up what was spent by both sides, and of course, as it turned out, it was a complete waste of people's time. It did have the effect of tying Shamasawant's hands while the council was considering final legislation for 2021. Okay. She hasn't been on top of her game in terms of some of the final bills that are coming up in December. And I think it probably also interfered with her ability to concentrate on the budget, because she was running a campaign, right?
Yeah.
And it most certainly ensured that she wouldn't be able to lobby for the council president's seat, even though she's the most senior council member at City Hall. She might not have been able to get enough votes to be next year's council president, but still, the recall vote, I think, was enormously disruptive to her business on the council, and certainly disruptive for, I think, the one council member who is most aligned to the concerns of workers, people of color, and the poor. So it did have that effect. That's really what the backers of the recall Sawant election got out of their $1 million that they spent.
Yeah, and also she was not nearly as active this year on the budget.
Yeah.
That's a big deal because he's been highly effective in past years.
Yeah. So I mean, she did put forward some amendments to the budget that passed and that were good, but not nearly as many, I think, as in the past. And that's what the recall, I think the main, purpose of the recall election. I know they were hoping to get Sharma kicked out of office, but you know, they didn't get nothing for that $1 million that they spent.
But, and they were also laying the groundwork for, you know, challenging her in 2023 when her term is up.
Yeah. So Sharma will continue to hold the District 3 seat on the city council in 2022 and 2023. She will be, as Job said, running for re-election in 2023, and we'll see what candidates go up against her in 2023.
Moving on. Mm-hmm. City, other city council related news.
Yeah, this week the council worked on several bills. There were some that will change the way the council operates. And among those are three kind of big impact bills. One will move the council briefing from Monday morning to Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. So that passed, and that will be a change in the coming year. And it will make it a discretionary meeting instead of a required one, which means that the council president can cancel that meeting if they feel that it's not needed. So the council briefing, instead of first thing Monday morning, is going to be now Tuesday afternoon, or now Monday afternoon. And then this will bump the weekly full council meeting from Monday afternoon to Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. And this is to give council staff more time to prepare bills for the full council to approve without having to work weekends as they typically do now. So that's also a big change. That's going to bump some committee meetings that happen on Tuesday to later in the week. But it may also give the public more time to consider, to think about whether they want to testify when the council takes the final vote on a bill, and may give the public more time to register their thoughts.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
And also, one big change is that council members can now abstain on any non-legally binding resolutions that don't pertain to city business that come up before the full council. Previously, they could only abstain in a committee meeting, and they had to vote yes or no in the full council meeting. That's still true for items that impact the city, like the budget and changes to city law, but it won't be true for, like, solidarity votes, for example, or resolutions that support struggles in other states or counties or other countries. So council members, if they don't know anything about an issue, can decide to abstain rather than vote yes or no on those bills. And then there was another bill that was in the works in the Public Safety Committee this week, one that I've talked about before. It's the bill that Lorena Gonzalez proposed to write a requirement into the municipal code that would require the city attorney to fund and support diversion programs. This bill has been amended to weaken it. Instead, it would now require the city attorney to notify the council 90 days ahead of making any changes to diversion programs, and it would require the city attorney to file quarterly reports with the council about the city's diversion programs.
So, who weakened that?
It was weakened for a couple reasons. The main one is that the city attorney has the responsibility under the city charter to make and direct decisions based on decisions in their office based on the law. So that power is reserved to the city attorney, not to the council. Okay. And there was some concern that this bill could impact that right under the city charter and might then conflict with the city charter. So the city council saying, look, the city attorney has to support diversion programs would be stepping on that right, essentially. So instead, because Lorena Gonzalez, who proposed the bill, is also an attorney, she took the advice of the council staff who gave the Public Safety Committee some advice on the legality of the bill as she proposed it, and she decided to amend it. Now, Ann Davison, the newly elected city attorney, cried foul and claimed that this was a sexist move by the council against the first woman to be elected city attorney. However, we know that the truth is that the council is concerned about Davison not because she's a woman, but because she's a Donald Trump supporter who's expressed open hostility to diversion programs. Okay.
And I would also point out that a majority of the council is female.
Yes. Andrew Lewis and Lisa Herbel had extended an invitation to Ann Davison to attend the Public Safety Committee meeting in which they discussed this bill. But, of course, Davison didn't show up and chose instead to accuse them of sexism instead, which I think is not...
It's going to be a long 4 years with her in office.
Yeah, it's not a good... Not a good precedent for what we can expect from Ann Davison in the future. Now, Lorena Gonzalez and Andrew Lewis then had to explain their thought process, with Lewis saying that quarterly reporting to the council is a good thing, and he thinks that more city departments should be required to provide quarterly reports to the city council.
I predict she will not.
She will not comply, yeah.
Not comply, yeah.
And notably, the bill doesn't include any consequences if the city attorney decides not to provide any reports to the council or decides to starve the diversion programs of the funding that the council included in the 2022 budget. So there's no enforcement mechanism in this law. In the meantime, one quarter of the staff in the city attorney's department has resigned this fall. And current city attorney Pete Holmes has already started up the process of interviewing replacements, hoping, I think, to forestall a scenario in which Ann Davison takes office and then appoints a bunch of unqualified cronies, very similar to what Donald Trump did, right? Of course, you could argue Ann Davison's not really qualified to hold the city attorney's job, but that's, you know, that's the voters' decision, right? Pete Holmes has invited Davison to sit in on the interviews, but I honestly don't know if she's actually taken him up on that. My guess is she probably hasn't. So that's the situation of what happened in the city council this week. And of course, already we're seeing fighting between Ann Davison and some city council members.
Yeah.
I know. It's going to be an interesting 4 years with Davison as city attorney.
Long.
We'll see.
Years.
We may be the entire population of Seattle may be voting at some point to recall Ann Davison. I don't know.
Yeah. Although I can't imagine that the new mayor will hold her accountable either.
Yeah, that's true.
Like you say, it's going to be an interesting 4 years for a lot of reasons.
Well, that was a feel-good item.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to redistricting developments.
Yeah. The Washington Coalition for Open Government filed their lawsuit this week, charging that the Washington Redistricting Commission violated the state's Open Public Meetings Act by caucusing in private and then voting at the last possible minute for redistricting maps that, were not made public prior to the vote. In fact, the maps were not fully drawn and made available to the public until the day after the vote was held to approve them. The vote was taken just moments before a midnight deadline on November 15th. And it appears now that the commission didn't fully adjourn after they took that vote at midnight on November 15th. They spent the rest of the night drawing up the maps that they had supposedly already drawn up and voted on. Staffers who helped the commission now say that there were still multiple versions of the maps circulating after the vote had already been taken. So they had to gather. Yeah, they had to gather in a room at a hotel with the commissioners and talk through the actual boundaries on the maps after the vote had already been taken. Apparently, major decisions were made that night in private, long after the vote, right? Now, for example, one staffer described Democrat Commissioner Brady Walkinshaw standing in a corner negotiating with the Republican Commissioner Joe Fain about whether the city of Normandy Park should be in the 9th or the 7th congressional district. Now, that's not a small change. Okay, that's a major change. The lawsuit has been filed in Thurston County Superior Court and simultaneously with the state Supreme Court in case the state Supreme Court decides to take it up directly. A Superior Court judge could rule that the maps are not valid and impose a fine of $500 on each commissioner. But I would say, looking at the prospects for this, it's unlikely that the commission would go back to the table to redraw the maps. Instead, they would probably just take another vote, this time in public, on the maps that they did finally draw up. Last week, I want to remind folks, the Washington State Supreme Court ruled that they would not step in and interfere in the process of drawing up new maps. Instead, they ruled that the two maps, a state legislative district map and a map of U.S. congressional districts in Washington state, was a valid work product of the redistricting commission, and that those two maps can now be sent to the state legislature for approval this spring. But already, state legislators from both parties are expressing concerns about the process that happened this year to redraw those maps, and they are making complaints about how the maps are flawed, and that they may not comply with federal law. So that may be a contentious process in the state legislature as well. In the meantime, a coalition of groups called Redistricting Justice for Washington is getting ready to file a lawsuit that will challenge the maps in court, saying that they violate the Voting Rights Act in the Yakima Valley, a region that is heavily Latino and has been split up into multiple districts in violation of federal voting rights law, which says that a redistricting commission has to take into account, has to try not to split up major communities like a full city or major groups of folks of a similar ethnicity, like, for example, Black voters or Latino voters.
And splitting the Yakima Valley up, we should explain, has the effect of ensuring that Latinos are not a majority in one district and therefore can't elect a representative that they feel good about.
Yeah. As anyone who is familiar with Washington state politics, particularly our representatives to the U.S. Congress, knows that the districts in Western Washington are heavily Democrat. The districts that are east of the Cascades, and that includes the Yakima Valley, those districts tend to vote Republican, but that's partly because of the way the maps are drawn. So this could be another lawsuit that could invalidate these two maps that were drawn after the redistricting commission voted on them. So
wow.
That's the state of redistricting in Washington. And I think it really, this whole process, including all of these lawsuits, could really have been prevented if we had a more open and, a less partisan process for redistricting in Washington. There are other states that do it better, and we need to look at how they do it and maybe consider doing that here.
Yeah, the net effect for many years has been that, Washington State's commission is equally split up among Democratic and Republican commissioners. And the effect of that is to protect the incumbents in both parties. I'll protect your incumbent if you protect my incumbent. And it really makes it very difficult for the only real example of a district switching parties recently has been the 8th district, and that was in spite of the 2010 commission adding Kittitas County to try and keep it Republican. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to do. In this case, it happened because the east side has added so many more people over the last 10 years that it swung the district, because the people that's added have tended to vote Democratic. So, it's very, very difficult for a district in Washington state to switch parties. It just doesn't happen very much.
Yeah, and the main opportunity for that to happen is either a major Democratic shift over time, as we saw in the 8th district, or redrawing the district boundaries, as we're seeing with this whole redistricting struggle.
And
now,
there were no new districts this time, because in the past, of course, that's been part of the calculus also. Mm-hmm. Well, we're creating a new 10th district, which party should be able to have a majority in it. Because a lot of that district was carved off of Southwest Washington, which tends to vote Republican. But the larger percentage was the Olympia area, which tends to vote Democratic.
Yeah, and the districts have to have an equal number of people in them, equal number of voters in them. So redrawing the district maps can be kind of tricky sometimes. But in other states, here in the state of Washington, the way redistricting is done is there's 5 members of the commission, one member is appointed as a sort of leader of the commission who doesn't have any voting power. And then each party in each body of the state legislature gets to appoint one member to the commission. So the 4 other members, one will be the Democrats in the House, one will be appointed by the Republicans in the House, one by the Democrats in the Senate, and one by the Republicans in the Senate. So an even number of Democrats and Republicans, and of course that means there's a whole lot of discussion and a whole lot of negotiating between the two parties to try to keep their own incumbents seated, right, and not redraw the boundaries to draw a current representative out of their own district, and 2, to keep a district that already votes Republican or already votes Democrat weighted in that party's favor. But that's not one of the requirements under the Federal Voting Rights Act. Okay. So negotiations that rely very heavily on keeping incumbents seated may also violate the Federal Voting Rights Act by, say, for example, splitting up the Latino population in the Yakima Valley. So that's what's at stake in the lawsuit that's being prepared by Redistricting Justice for Washington. And I expect that will be filed in the next couple weeks, probably.
Yeah, and obviously that has major implications for the future of our democratic process.
Yeah, and other states do it better. Some states have a whole different way of choosing their commissioners. For example, you could have citizens who, you could have a certain number of citizens who are Democrats, a certain number of citizens who are Republicans, and then a much larger group of citizens who are nonpartisan sit on a redistricting commission, so that you have representatives of both parties, but also people who are not interested in keeping incumbents in office. They're interested in drawing up a fair map. That is something that I think the state of Washington needs to consider.
And my understanding is the person who's selected in the non-voting aspect for the Washington Commission, they like to choose someone who's been previously a kindergarten teacher to get both sides really working together.
Yeah.
So a little fact you probably didn't know about. All right. Let's, unless you have anything else on that.
No, I'm done on that one.
Move on to this week's pandemic news.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of pandemic news this week. First, the Department of Health of the state announced yesterday that a 4th case of the Omicron variant has been found in Washington state. This one in Whatcom County. And, They did not give a lot of important details, and they haven't given details on the previous cases. they've given the gender and age of, or approximate age, of the person who has been infected, but we don't know, for example, how serious the case is, nor do we know whether they had any travel history. The travel history is important because it would tell us if they imported the variant from, say, traveling to South Africa or Europe, from Europe to Washington State, or whether there's community spread. So we don't know that. We do know that the Whatcom County case is a man in his 30s, but we don't know, have any details on who that person is, what part of the county they live in, or whether there's any travel history. So
we do know about the one case here in King County was a woman who didn't have any travel history. So that hints that maybe at least here in King County, there may be community spread of the Omicron variant already.
Yeah, or she got that case from traveling to Thurston County or Pierce County. We just don't know.
Well, that's cheery news.
Yeah, the other local COVID news. Case counts in Washington State had been falling here since mid-September, but they're now back on the upswing again. And you know, the holidays are coming up when people travel a lot and gather indoors together. So I was taking a look.
I think that upswing has a lot to do with the Thanksgiving holiday also.
Yeah, so I was taking a look at the epidemiologic curve in Washington State to kind of get a sense for when it swings upward. And I noticed that you could see a small upswing at the start of the pandemic in April 2020, and then it went down. And then a larger upswing in July 2020 when everyone thought it was maybe safe to go back to normal, but it really wasn't. And then it went down again in the summer. And then the third big upswing was over the holidays of December to January 2021. And that was a huge upswing that dwarfed all the previous ones. And then again, after the holidays were over, it started to trend down again, right? But then there was a smaller fourth upswing in April and May of 2021 as people started to get vaccinated. And then everyone started to relax, thinking, okay, it's over now that we're vaccinated. But then it trended down again as more people got vaccinated. But then the Delta variant hit in August, and that's brought the largest upswing to date. So if you really take a look on the state's COVID-19 dashboard, you see what impact the Delta variant had in August through September. And then about September started to trend downward again, and we were looking really good. But now we've got the Omicron variant, and we've got the holidays again. And with those two combined, I think we may be looking at an even larger upswing than we saw with the Delta variant.
Yeah, I agree with that. The CDC did release a count to date of Omicron in the United States. There have been 85 cases in 22 different states. They did not specify how many of those cases were community spread, which was, you know, tell us where future hotspots might be. The vast majority of cases in the United States are currently Delta, and that's continuing to increase, especially in northern states. Michigan has been hit very hard. Upstate New York has been hit very hard. Minnesota has been hit hard. New England. And so, you know, a lot of these areas, and I've mentioned this for a couple of weeks now, are areas where, winter weather is in full swing. Mm-hmm. So you've got people staying indoors, often in badly ventilated areas, and this is an airborne disease. So, you're getting massive increases in cases in those states. And you're also starting to run into real shortages in healthcare professionals who can address these cases. The burnout is a serious problem for people who have been working insane hours for the better part of 2 years. And you don't have enough people coming online, say in nursing or doctors, to replace them. You don't have enough people to teach the doctors or teach the nurses in order to replace them. There's shortages in that, too.
So just like in other industries where a lot of older folks are retiring early just because they don't like the hassle of having to try to work from home, in the healthcare profession, there's a lot of burnout, especially among older folks who are ready, who are close to retirement, and they're thinking, I'll just retire a couple, 2 or 3 years early, and who's coming online to replace them? Well, not enough people. That's true all across the U.S. in all kinds of different professions, but it's doubly true in the healthcare professions, partly because of the insane hours and treating people with COVID-19, particularly people who have decided for whatever reason to not get vaccinated. Because, you know, who knows, they're scared of their own natural antibodies or they're scared of needles. I don't know. But it's enormously frustrating for healthcare professionals who assumed that once the vaccines were available, that the pandemic would wane and they would get some relief. And now they're seeing an even larger upswing among people getting sick with the Delta variant who just decided for whatever, you know, stupid reason to not get vaccinated.
Yeah, and who would want to go into that profession when you can see from, you know, the papers and news coverage that they were already struggling for decent pay and, you know, decent working conditions. And then you combine, you know, the last 2 years of complete, you know, stressful burnout. I can't imagine the lines are very long,
and
you know.
If your idea is I want to go into a profession where I'll, you know, be rewarded for my work and I'll feel good about what I do and I won't get exposed to COVID-19, the last thing you would choose is the healthcare profession, right? Especially nursing.
You know, this weekend, the United States will reach 50 million confirmed cases and 800,000 deaths. We'll hit both of those milestones probably sometime on Sunday. And of those 800,000 deaths, 400,000 of them came in the first year of the pandemic under Donald Trump. And another 400,000 have come this year. And about 350,000 of those have been entirely preventable. You know, almost all of the cases since the vaccine became widely available, which is about March, you know, it varied from state to state. Because of the initial restrictions on who was eligible for the vaccines. But, you know, almost all of the cases since then have been among unvaccinated people. Almost all of the hospitalizations have been unvaccinated. Almost all of the deaths have been unvaccinated. And it's got to be incredibly frustrating for healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, because these have been entirely preventable deaths.
I agree. Yeah.
And not only have they been entirely preventable, but, again, you know, the people who have died have by and large been people who, you know, essentially chose their own death. Because they didn't want to get a shot that takes almost no time or effort and is absolutely free.
Yeah, about 60% of the U.S. is vaccinated. So another 40%. And that's a lot of people, you know, 300 million. What? Let's do the math. Yeah. 320 million times 40%, 128 million people, right? That's a lot of people.
And some of those people are partially vaccinated. In fact, the United States reached another milestone this week, which was 200 million people who've had at least one vaccine shot. But a number of those people, for one reason or another, had one shot and then didn't come back for the second course, let alone a booster shot.
Mm-hmm. And for some people, it's that they work a job where they don't get paid sick leave, right? Or they can't afford to take a day off that's unpaid. And that means that although some employers have allowed their staff to take days off, unpaid days off to get vaccinated, or have paid their staff to get vaccinated, there are still many, many that have not. And that needs to change.
Yeah, or if they don't show up to the work, they might get fired.
Mm-hmm.
That's a concern, too. So the United States did reach a milestone of 200 million people who've had that partial vaccination at least, but not all of them have had full vaccination.
Yeah, and that's still about 120 million who are not fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
Who are not even partially vaccinated.
Yeah, and we heard from Dr. Fauci this week that it's a matter of time before the definition of fully vaccinated changes to include booster shots. And because, of course, the efficacy of the vaccine decays over time, basically. And for a lot of people, that efficacy is already declining, and they have not had booster shots. So that's going to be a factor going forward with the fifth wave this winter. You know, the percentage of Americans who've had booster shots is still only about 20%. So it's much lower than people who've been fully vaccinated. Only about 1 in 3, who've had the second shot have gone on to get a third shot.
Yeah.
So how's the rest of the world doing?
Not well. Of course, we've seen South Africa, where Omicron has very quickly become the dominant variant, overtaking Delta, which originally hit South Africa very hard. You know, these past, well, summer months in the Northern Hemisphere anyway. But now, yesterday, the health authority in the UK said they expect Omicron to be dominant there within a couple of weeks, by the middle of the month, actually within the week, which is really very frightening, because it was found in the UK only a couple of weeks ago, and it initially had relatively few cases. Now it's got a lot of cases.
It's very fast.
And because that.
And some scientists
because
are saying
that society is much more like the U.S. than South Africa is.
Yeah, and scientists are saying that they think the Omicron variant is about twice as transmissible as the Delta variant, which was already more transmissible than the original version of COVID-19. They're still trying to figure out how severe the Omicron variant is versus the Delta variant. They feel that it may be less severe than the Delta variant, but that it's still early days yet. And they're not sure if that's because more people who are vaccinated now have gotten sick with Omicron versus the Delta variant. And it may take some time for them to see how the Omicron variant actually affects people who are unvaccinated before they can really determine whether that's the case or not. The hope is that COVID-19 will be like other viruses in human history that started out being very severe and then over time became more easily transmissible, but also less severe. So causing less severe symptoms. They're hoping that's happening to COVID-19, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah. And the last couple of days, we've gotten a number of preliminary results to, lab studies, and that comes with an important caveat, because lab does not necessarily replicate in the field, in the real world, how a virus spreads and how severe it is. But there have been at least 5 or 6 different studies that have come online in the last couple of days, especially on Friday. Looking at those, we're seeing conclusions that Omicron is about 3 times as transmissible as Delta, which is a terrifying prospect, honestly. And we're seeing differing results about how severe it is. Some results they all say that it's not more severe than Delta.
Than Delta, yeah.
Some of them are saying that it's about as severe as Delta. Some of them are saying it's milder than Delta. And, you know, as the variant spreads in Europe, where societies have similar healthcare systems and similar societies to the United States, you know, we can look at some of those conclusions. For the time being, most of the data is coming out of the lab in Europe, or coming out of the field in South Africa.
One of the studies that came out of a lab this week is showing that the Pfizer announced that their booster would provide plenty of protection for people against the Omicron variant. But again, that was just a study of based on blood samples in a lab. It doesn't really replicate what the virus and what the booster shots do in the human body. So again, I think we're just kind of in the wild here, waiting to see what happens in societies like South Africa and in Europe, what happens with the Omicron variant there.
And we also had studies this week suggesting that the vaccines are less effective against Omicron,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
should also disturb people. The protection for people who've had booster shots is fairly good, but the protection for people who've had the two courses that were originally recommended, in some of those studies, it was looking like, efficacy decayed more quickly than it did for Delta. And in some cases, it suggested that that if you've only had the two shots, regardless of when you had them, that Omicron, the vaccines are less effective. Omicron has the capacity to evade vaccination antibodies or antibodies that are generated either by vaccine or by previous infection.
Yeah.
Infections are quite, people who are previously infected are quite vulnerable to Omicron.
Yeah. Now the CDC said on Friday that most of the cases of Omicron have shown up in people who are already vaccinated, and those have been mild cases. Half of those infected were between the ages of 18 and 39. Again, the one demographic that has resisted getting vaccinated the most. And one third of those infected had traveled internationally before getting sick. So it appears that there's already widespread community spread of the Omicron variant here in the United States, with two thirds of the cases in people who have not traveled internationally. Okay. 14 of the cases included people who had received booster shots, but many of them had received the boosters only recently and may not have reached their full antibody load from the booster shot. So, the reason to get the booster is that after about 6 months, your antibodies taper off. So, you know, the booster shot will spur your immune system to make more natural antibodies to the COVID spike protein. Now, the question that people have is, does the antibodies to the COVID spike protein in these vaccines match the spike protein in the Omicron? And, the answer is that there have been mutations in that spike protein in the Omicron variant that could allow it to evade the antibodies that your body makes to the boosters. And with the CDC saying that most of the cases have been in people who've already been vaccinated, that appears to be the case. However, even if there are differences in the spike proteins, your body may recognize the Omicron variant. If you've been vaccinated, your body may recognize the Omicron variant as similar to the vaccines. Okay, it may recognize the spike protein as similar to and marshal a defense if you have a strong immune system. The people who really need to be ultra careful are older folks whose immune systems are waning, and people who have a suppressed immune system because maybe they're transplant patients or they're undergoing cancer treatment. And of course, people who have very young children at home with developing immune systems. So that means, of course,
and who are by definition unvaccinated.
Yeah. And that means, of course, that all the rest of us need to do our part too and make sure that we don't get sick and spread the virus to those folks. So, you know, not much has changed. It's almost 2 years out, and here we are dealing with vaccines and dealing with masking. Of course, hand washing, and I'm still seeing folks who are saying, hey, I want to go back to normal. I want to live life as normal. And they're going out unmasked. They're walking around indoors unmasked in group housing, even in my own apartment building. I'm seeing people in the hallway walking around unmasked, and they're asking to just create another huge wave of infection.
Yeah. And, the CDC's report on Friday comes with a really important caveat, which is that there's only 85 cases. It's a pretty small sample size.
Yeah, that's
so,
too small
so
a sample
they're,
size.
They're really preliminary conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
The other important thing that the CDC said was that of those 85, only one person has been hospitalized so far.
Yeah.
But hospitalization is a lagging indicator. There has not been time in many of these cases for more serious illness to develop. So that's something we'll have to keep an eye on over the coming weeks, as the Omicron spread, as it almost certainly will. Right now, California and New York State are the two states with the most cases. And curiously, Nebraska also has had a huge spike in cases. Many of those coming from the original one family, six of whose members were infected. And then, of course, they spread it around to their community. So Omicron is extremely contagious. That much we know for certain.
All right. Well, reasonable
ho,
chance.
Ho, ho,
ho. We'll be talking about this again next week.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, and the week after, and the week after. Yep.
Yes.
All right. Let's, Jav, talk a bit about the Minnesota police officer who's on trial this week.
Yeah, Kim Potter is the officer in Brooklyn Center, in Minnesota, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, who shot and killed Dante Wright late last summer, leading to what was really the last major series of protests of all of the summer protests last year. And of course, it came in the wake of in the same area George Floyd being killed originally. So Ms. Potter is on trial in Minneapolis this week. And this past week, there have been a number of witnesses for the prosecution this week, all of whom have painted, including some of the police officers involved, all of whom have painted a really damning picture of how Brooklyn Center Police handled what should have been a routine traffic stop. Now, Potter herself has claimed that she thought she was holding a taser when in fact she was holding her gun, her service piece, and she accidentally shot Dante Wright. And as many people have pointed out, a taser is an entirely different shape and weight and feel than a pistol. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, especially for somebody who had been on the force for a number of years, trained other police officers, and, she had plenty of experience, so she should not have made that mistake if it was in fact a mistake. However, we have also learned in the trial this week that, Dante Wright did not receive any first aid. There were a number of officers on the scene. His car drifted down the road after he was shot until it ran head on into another vehicle, that was oncoming. The driver in that case, was uninjured, but the passenger was injured. It was a couple in their 80s. And that injured passenger has since been put in hospice. His health has declined radically. So that may be a second victim of this terrible tragedy. But again, Dante Wright was not given any first aid by the officer who was first on the scene of that accident down the road, nor did he receive any other first aid until somebody thought to check his pulse, and by that time he was dead, which is just tremendous negligence on behalf of all the officers who were there. We also heard that Wright's girlfriend, who was in the passenger seat when he was shot, and who was the only person who actually attempted to give Wright any first aid, although she didn't really know what to do. That was her testimony this week. She was pulled out of the car and arrested by officers until they determined that she actually hadn't committed any crimes other than being a passenger in a car where they shot the driver. She was prevented from giving any further first aid to Wright. It was just a mess all the way around. That is what has come out so far, in the trial. The prosecution is almost done with their witnesses, and then the defense will, presumably have, some witnesses of their own, trying to, prevent Potter from facing any legal culpability for her actions that day. And, to say this is a tense trial would be understating it.
Yeah. All right.
And many of the prosecution witnesses were extremely emotional when they described what happened. They were really pretty traumatized by having been witness to that whole debacle.
All right. Well, there is at least one other major trial that's taking place this week.
Yeah, Ghislaine Maxwell, I don't know what you would how you would describe her, but the number two to Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring is on trial for helping abet that sex trafficking. The prosecution had its witnesses this week, and there were a number of very emotional descriptions by the young women who were victimized by Epstein and allegedly Maxwell. Describing what they were put through and what they were forced to do as part of that that circus. It's also because Maxwell has refused to cooperate with authorities. We still don't really know who availed themselves of Epstein's young women. Of course, a number of very prominent, very wealthy people were regular guests of Epstein at one point or another in his career with young women. Among the names that have been conspicuously reported already are Donald Trump, Prince Andrew of Britain, and the list goes on and on. A number of prominent politicians and business figures that Epstein courted, and he courted their friendship by offering this young woman to them for sex. That is what Maxwell is accused of is helping to set that up by helping to recruit the young woman as part of the sex trafficking ring. And it's considered sex trafficking not just because they were forced into things they didn't necessarily want to do. but because Epstein shuttled the young woman among his five houses, including out of the country and in different parts of the United States, Manhattan, New Mexico, etc. So it's been very emotional. The defense, beginning on Monday, will start presenting their witnesses, and it's not a trial for the for people who are easily nauseated. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I just realized there was another major trial this week that we have neglected to mention, and that is of Julian Assange being tried in the UK and apparently being cleared for extradition to the United States now.
Yes, that has happened as well. And, of course, the defenders of Assange are crying foul. He is wanted in the United States, basically as a political vendetta for his having shared secrets, and he is facing, I believe, charges of, essentially treason. So, yeah, we'll have to watch that fairly carefully going forward as well. And something else I should mention about the Maxwell trial is that that is, there have been, of course, as the disinformation and conspiracy theories among, anti-vaxxers go, and you may wonder, well, what does that have to do with Maxwell? Well, one of the conspiracy theories about the development of Omicron is that it has been released by the powers that be to try and distract attention from the Maxwell trial. I swear to God, this is a thing on the internet. Don't believe everything you read on the internet. There are a number of different conspiracy theories. That was kind of my favorite just because it's so preposterous. But most of them are preposterous. All of them, actually. Because they all involve Omicron being intentionally released or intentionally developed and released, by them in order to, you know, advance whatever, dark, priorities they have among people who rule the world. No, that's not what's happening. That's what's going on with Maxwell. Yep.
All right. 2 minutes. I'm going to hold you to 2 minutes, to touch on, the tornadoes and, climate issues this week.
Yeah. Of course, it's dominating the news this weekend, the huge supercell of storms that passed through the south central U.S. Friday night. The governor of Kentucky was speaking this morning, and he said he thought the death toll could exceed 100 people by the time they're done. So far, 70 have been confirmed dead. Yeah. That's just in Kentucky.
I think it's important to note that it is not tornado season. Okay.
No, I was just about to get there.
Yeah.
Not only were these F4 and F5 tornadoes, but one of them was tracked for 250 miles, which is insane. That is virtually unprecedented at any time of year. And here we are 2 weeks from Christmas. And this makes the follow up particularly important in those cities that were hardest hit. Heading that list right now is a city of about 10,000 in western Kentucky called Mayfield. Literally the whole city has been destroyed by one tornado. And that means a lot of people are going to need to be housed. And it's winter. There's snow on the ground in Mayfield. And,
yeah. Typically tornado season in the U.S., in some places it's February through May, but for most of the U.S., it's midsummer, kind of June, July. And to have a tornado of this size and, that persistence to occur in December is just, not just a freak weather incident, but I think a sign of real climate change and probably a sign of what we can expect for the future.
Normally this time of year, tornadoes are a thing really only on the counties right along the Gulf Coast. I mean, right along the Gulf Coast. This is several hundred miles north of there. And that's the one element that's missing from all of the coverage right now is that, you know, the hardest hit, state, not only is this a sign of climate change and storms to come in the future, but this particular state is represented in Congress by two of the highest profile deniers of climate change. Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell. McConnell himself alone has done more to block climate change legislation than virtually anybody else in Congress. And this has hit his state very hard. And it's really unfortunate that the media coverage, at least so far, is not making that connection. That this is another sign of extreme weather that we are not used to that's going to become more and more of a thing in future years. Climate change is here. And while, in this case, you can't necessarily equate any storm to the effects of climate change, but this one you can because it's absolutely unprecedented this time of year.
All right. Going to have to wrap up there.
Yep.
And Mitch McConnell can probably be happy to get some coal in his stocking. So.
Yeah, probably. Because, after all, Kentucky is a coal state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, talk to you both same time next week.
Sounds like a plan.
We'll be here.